Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Journalist Helene Cooper was born into wealth and privilege in Liberia. A member of that country's elite ruling class, the descendants of freed American slaves who went back to Africa and created a nation. Her life changed forever when her family, after generations, fled back to the United States to escape a bloody coup in Liberia. Helene's new memoir describes her long journey from a mansion on Liberia's Sugar Beach to a new life in America and back again. This hour on Point, Helene Cooper, out of Africa and back again. You can join the conversation. Does Helene Cooper's story of exile, assimilation, and looking back speak to your own experience, your family's? Joining me now from St. Paul, Minnesota, is journalist Helene Cooper. She is descended from founders of Liberia, whose families returned to Africa after slavery in America. In 1980, her family fled Liberia for Tennessee and North Carolina eventually when a coup and uprising upended her privileged childhood. Since 2006, she's been diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. She spent 12 years as a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. She's the author of a new memoir, The House at Sugar Beach, In Search of a Lost African Childhood. You can read an excerpt, I should say, of the book at our website, onpointradio.org. Helene Cooper, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
This is an extraordinary story, but it's really hard to understand without a little bit of a history lesson, and I wish you'd give it to us in a nutshell. We'll go into more detail, but the origins of Liberia that led you and your family to live in this 22-room mansion on Sugar Beach outside Monrovia, the capital of Liberia, in the mid-late 20th century. Take us back to the historic story that made that possible, that planted the seeds for that, and how your family was involved in it.
It's really an extraordinary story, you know, when you think about it. And when I was doing some of the historical research for the book, I was stunned myself. Back in the early 1800s, there was a Back to Africa movement that started in the United States. The American Colonization Society, which was a group of abolitionists from the North, joined with a lot of slave owners from the South who decided that they wanted to get rid of this class of freed blacks that were in the United States. They didn't like the idea, particularly the slave owners in the South, didn't like the idea of freed blacks living side by side with enslaved blacks.
So it wasn't really for them. It wasn't really for slaves. It was for those who had wriggled out of slavery somehow.
Yeah, it was for. But although a lot of plantation owners did free their slaves under the grounds that they then leave the country and go back to Liberia. So my great-great-great-great-grandfather, Elijah Johnson, was on the first ship of these freed blacks. There were 88 of them that left New York Harbor on a very cold, blustery February morning in 1820 and made the five-week journey to what was then, at the time, Sierra Leone. And they spent 2 years going around from place to place on the West African coast looking for some land to buy, and finally ended up in what became Liberia.
This is in between Sierra Leone and what's now Ivory Coast there on that sort of southwest corner of West Africa, jutting out into the Atlantic.
There. Right into the Atlantic Ocean. Now, the irony is that these freed blacks went and basically set up the same sort of antebellum society that they had fled. They set themselves up as the ruling elite. They had to fight the native Liberians when they got there because a lot of these native Liberians were still engaging in the slave trade. This was their, you know, the basis at the time still for the economy in West Africa. The free men went and immediately, you know, started abolished that. Britain had already abolished slave trade on the high seas, but there was a lot of slaving still going on. So that was one source of tension. Another source of tension was just that the freemen coming, the settlers coming from the United States, thought that they were coming to bring civilization to heathen Africans, mm-hmm. whereas the Africans thought that, you know, they were going to come and assume roles as, you know, pay homage to the tribal chiefs and kings in Africa, right. and become sort of a fight over who would be, you know, who would be the ruling group. And the colonists won. Because they were better armed. They received arms from the United States and the American Colonization mm-hmm. Society. My great-great-great-grandfather had fought in the War of 1812 against the British, mm-hmm. and he was a trained soldier, and he was one of the leaders who actually led in a lot of these battles with the Native Africans.
Your great-great-great-grandfather, who's still quoted, or was at least in your childhood, quoted in Liberian history books for his encouragement to those first Liberians. And what emerged from this then that you were heir to, Helene, was very much a divided society with what was called the Congo people, who were the elite, kind of the ruling class, and the country people. Describe that social structure for us.
It was completely divided. The Congo people, and the term, but that was a derogatory term that the native Liberians came up with.
Okay.
And it sort of harkened back to the slaving days, where a lot of the slave ships entered the Atlantic from the mouth of the Congo River, which is nowhere near Liberia. But mm-hmm. A lot of these, when after Britain abolished the slave trade, would return these slave ships and free the slaves in Sierra Leone and sometimes Liberia. So all newcomers in the area became known as Congo people.
Mm-hmm.
And the so-called Congo people, these settlers, sort of retaliated by calling the native Africans the country people.
So I'm throwing these around lightly, but these are both derogatory. Yeah.
They're totally derogatory mm-hmm. terms. And mm-hmm. I use them in the book just sort of because that's how we grew up referring to each other. It's nothing that you would do. You would not mm-hmm. want to do that now, but that's the reality of how stratified Liberian society was at the time.
What percentage of the economic, the ruling elite were the returned outsiders, and what, describe the nature, if you would, for us of the power, the status they had over Africans who had been there and their descendants when they returned.
Well, about 65% of the wealth of the country was concentrated in the hands of 5% of the population. Those were the Congo people. Mm-hmm. They owned the land, they ran the businesses, and the rest of the country. Made up the rest. You know, they were the farmers, they were the tenants, they were the servants. You know, they had been, you know, as gradually over the 150 years to come, there was some intermarriage, but you could always sort of graduate up to be considered Congo, but you would never graduate yourself down.
And did were most of that 5% at the top of the country there descendants or claimed descendants of returned slave families?
Yes, most of them started out that way. As Liberia progressed and as you got into the 1900s and, you know, into the 20th century, Liberia sort of became a melting pot for the African diaspora. And you saw settlers coming from other African countries, from the West Indies, and they sort of, you know, newcomers for some reason always sort of graduated into that elite status.
And so as a child, you felt what? You were born to rule, born to be rich, born to live in this big house on Sugar Beach between Monrovia and the airport.
I was a complete princess. I grew up, you know, with the proverbial silver spoon in my mouth and completely, you know, blind, you know, not paying attention to what was going on around me. My parents took me on vacation in Spain where we had a house and, you know, we had servants and I had a nurse and, you know, I knew that there was, you know, I look back now and it's so incredible to imagine how clueless you can be about what, you know, how you can make yourself clueless. But I grew up thinking that that's the way things were everywhere.
With your Lincoln and your new Pontiac and your shag rugs and 22 rooms and the Jackson 5.
Baby.
of course, this is what, the 60s and 70s, really, when you were, it was finally, you were 14, I guess, when you left in 1980. But you were a girl, and this was your reality, living large on the beach while most of the country was in what kind of circumstance?
Most of the country was in poverty. It's not the kind of poverty that you see In some places now in Liberia because of the years of war. But it was definitely, you know, no running water or electricity in a lot of, in so many of the houses. You know, a lot of, you know, if you had electricity, you were basically middle class in Liberia. You know, people had outside toilets. You had women, the market women who, you know, drove the economy, but selling on the streets. And you had, you know, the literacy rate was very low. I think it was about 25%, which was abysmal. Things were improving, but they were improving excruciatingly slowly, you know, and I think the sort of the governing elite was pretty complacent. I remember we would look around, and this was in the 70s, and there were coups going on in all these African countries, and we would think, oh, how, you know, how much better off we are here in Liberia. This, you know, nothing like this ever happens here. We've got our act together.
And then one day it all came tumbling down for the elite across the country and right into your home.
Yeah, I did. In 1980, a group of enlisted soldiers led by Samuel Doe stormed the executive mansion, disemboweled the president, William Tolbert, and overthrew the government and announced that Liberia was basically under new rule. They targeted a lot of the government ministers, including my cousin, who we called uncle at the time, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, who was executed on the beach. They went after the so-called Congo people. They came to our house. They terrorized us. My mother had to basically sacrifice herself to save her daughters. My father was shot. And 150 years of, you know, this rule just sort of all of a sudden upended, and kind of my world crashed down around me. It was a very rude awakening to something I should have probably seen coming.
Though maybe it's too much to ask of a girl, but there's much more we want to hear here. Helene Cooper, now diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. Her new memoir is The House at Sugar Beach. Behind us, political music from President William Tubman way back when in Liberia. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
The president is a statesman who gives men what they need, a uniting ideology that answers hate and greed. He's the leader of
Liberia, land of liberty. What a place to be. President Tubman will lead the way to a brand new day, setting the nation free.
We're talking this hour with New York Times diplomatic correspondent Helene Cooper about her new memoir of growing up elite in Africa and the destruction of everything she knew. Her new book, and it's quite wonderful, is The House at Sugar Beach, In Search of a Lost African Childhood. And you can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Helene, I wish you'd read just a bit for us describing that house of your family, part of the Liberian elite from early on in The House at Sugar Beach.
This was our house at Sugar Beach. A futuristic three-level verandaed 1970s-era behemoth with a massive glass dome on top, visible as soon as you turned onto the dirt road junction a mile away. The house revealed itself slowly, like a coquettish Parisian dancer from the 1920s, emerging from the road's first major pothole, big enough to swallow a small European car. Your reward was a glimpse of the house's sloping roof and glass dome, shining in the equatorial sun. Rounding the bend between the dense bush of plum trees and vines, you next got a glimpse of the house's eastern wraparound second-floor porches, painted creamy butter with a roasted red pepper trim hand-selected for tropical contrast. Driving by the two huts that form the outermost edge of the nearby Basso village of Bubba Town, you then caught another tease, the sliding glass doors that form the perimeter of the second-floor living room. But nothing could prepare you for the final disrobing as you crested the hill that opened up to the panoramic view of the house, backlit by the thunderous waves and pounding surf from the Atlantic as far as the eye could see. Shangri-La, Camelot, the Garden of Eden, the Cooper family's perfect and perfectly grand paradise, where John and Calista Cooper could raise their perfect family, cosseted by well-paid servants and protected from the ravages of West African squalor and poverty by central air conditioning, strategically placed coconut trees, and a private water well.
Helene Cooper reading from her memoir, The House at Sugar Beach, a portrait of her family's African idol there, very unique circumstances in Liberia, a country founded by families of returned, one-time American slaves. Helene, I know you were very young then, but I wish you could paint the mentality or convey it to us from your own experience, from your conversations with parents and family. I mean, what you described there seems almost dropped down, you know, as if from outer space or as if from the United States.
America.
From America. And I mean, I'm reading in the book, you talk about Sadie Hawkins dance that you would be there in the fall. You'd have what you call the Hick Day, as in Hicks from the mm-hmm. Sticks, Hick Day yeah. talent show, and you know, dancing numbers from King of the Road and your gang sort of dancing to John Travolta's Saturday Night Fever and all that. What were you and your parents thinking? How did you see the world and your place in it?
We saw the world as perfectly normal, and I saw the world as mine for the taking. I had no, you know, when I look back now, I think I'm probably one of the luckiest people, you know, in the world by a stroke of luck that I had absolutely nothing to do with. I was somehow born into what passed for the landed gentry upper class of Africa's first independent country. So I was sort of free from any kind of internalized, you know, inferiority complex or racism. I didn't have any of the baggage that a lot of African children growing up in post-colonial Africa, including Liberia, you know, including the native Liberians had, because, you know, I was a princess and I thought, let everybody else try to be equal to me. At the same time, I didn't have any of the post-Civil War baggage that a lot of Black American girls grew up with who were my age in the United States. So it was a sort of, you know, I realized I didn't, of course, I had no clue and never thought about it at the time, but it was actually in many ways a really extraordinary upbringing, and one that, you know, sort of put me in the lucky nano percent of Africans or Blacks around the world.
And what about your parents' perspective? They could hardly be that naive. They knew Liberia's story was absolutely unique in its roots, that their circumstances were, as you say, part of a tiny elite net country, 5% of the country holding 65% of the wealth. I mean, Americans know something about that. I'm looking, you know, 2001, 1% of this country had 33% of the wealth. So we know about concentration. But still, how did they look at it? Did it seem durable to them? Did it seem absurd to be, you know, dancing to Jackson 5 at the very tip, you know, beachfront tip of a country with so much old-fashioned poverty?
I think in yes and no. My parents sort of grew up in the same sort of privileged background that I did, but they also grew up with sort of that nonchalance that a lot of wealthy people have. They were very, very enormously proud of my ancestors. As I grew up, my mom and my dad both talked to me about Elijah Johnson, you know, on my mom's side, and about the four Cooper brothers on my father's side who got on the ship in Norfolk, Virginia in 1829 mm-hmm. to go to Liberia, and how they got to Liberia with nothing, and how they, you know, built a country with the sweat of their brow, and they fought the natives, and if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be, you know, I was told
so
all
really
the time. So
really a kind of mirror image
them.
Of the American story, just
yeah,
flipped
yeah,
in another
way. Yeah, image. Absolutely. If it wasn't for them, you wouldn't be here today, and mm-hmm. Everything you owe to the fact that they fought and they stood their ground, and there was a lot of that pioneer pride in what my ancestors went through. There wasn't as much questioning of, you know, the sort of society that we lived in. But as I grew older and as I started listening sort of to the political conversations that my dad had with his friends in the recreation room, and I would sneak down there and, you know, try to pretend that I could hang with them reading, you know, pretending that I was reading. I remember sitting in a velvet chair in the recreation room while my dad came down with a bunch of his friends, and I wanted to impress them. So I had a Newsweek magazine in my my lap, mm-hmm. and they're talking politics, and they're talking about Africa, and they're talking, it was all a lot of talk about the Cold War and how Africa was going to be used as a pawn, and how America could lose its influence in Liberia if it didn't pay us more attention. And it was that sort of thing. It was much more geopolitical than looking at what exactly was happening right there within Liberia. But that's, you know, that's not necessarily to say that they weren't discussing it, but that's not what I was hearing.
You were hearing something more durable, but there was obviously tremendous tension here and bitterness, and there came that terrible day for your family in what, April 1980, when rebel soldiers showed up at your house, eight or I don't know of them, and before it was over, your world was shattered. Your mother had been gang raped in the basement of that big, beautiful house, and you and your sisters narrowly escaping.
Yeah, that was sort of my, I kind of look at that as the end of my childhood and my awakening to the world as it was. And it was, I do remember feeling absolutely stunned at, you know, the fact that what I thought is like stunning, that human beings were capable of this. It was completely outside my realm of familiarity that something like this could happen.
You have a reading from the day when the soldiers showed up. I wonder if you could just share it with us. We have the image of that mansion at Sugar Beach in our mind, and then here comes 1980.
Then we saw the truck flash briefly through the trees up the road as it approached the house, a cloud of dust trailing it. My stomach clenched. It wasn't rogues coming to Sugar Beach this time. These intruders weren't bothering to cloak themselves under cover of darkness. They were brazen. They had nothing to hide from and nothing to fear, and they could come into our yard and into our house and take whatever they wanted and do whatever they wanted to us. Eunice and I bolted into the house, yelling, "Anne La, Mami, soldiers!" Marlene's dogs, all four of them, were barking furiously, running up to the approaching truck and then back to the house, as if they wanted to make sure the truckload of soldiers were properly escorted to us. Mami, dressed in a black t-shirt and green shorts, went to the kitchen porch, then yelled back at us, "Y'all stay inside." But we were, all three, Marlene, Eunice, and I, peering from the kitchen window, in full view of the truckload of soldiers who were now pouring out of the truck and onto the yard in front of the house. There were eight of them. Some wore green fatigues, some wore tank tops that showed off their shoulders and arms, with scars and markings on them. One wore a uniform that looked to be that of some kind of non-commissioned officer. He pulled up his belt and strutted to the front of the house. He looked at Mommy, standing above him on the porch, and grinned. Then he looked at us, peering from the kitchen window, and grinned some more.
Helene Cooper reading from her memoir, The House at Sugar Beach, and things got bad, terrible, in a hurry right there. Within no time, you were gone from the country. You mentioned rogues there, just one piece of the kind of Liberian English, rogues as in burglars that had plagued the house for a long time. But this was a whole different thing, and very soon you and your family were gone, were refugees in the United States. How did that slingshot work?
It was quite a slingshot. I mean, you mentioned the rogues, and it's sort of interesting because we're very superstitious in Liberia, and we're afraid of rogues and heart men and Niji and all sorts of underwater spirits. And it was in part my fear of the rogues that used to come to the house that prodded my parents to go and adopt a sister, Eunice, for me, who would be my playmate, and we would sleep in the same room, and that's that sort of thing. We were raised as sisters. When we did flee Liberia, we ended up leaving her. She chose to stay with her family, and that was probably even more traumatic for me than what had just happened to my family, because we went in one fell swoop from being, you know, these privileged upper class, whatever. I was a popular girl at school, to suddenly I was the suspicious African refugee at my new school in Knoxville, Tennessee. And I was, you know, for the first time in 7 years without my best friend and my sister, Eunice. So I was pretty traumatized, I think, at the time, and kind of, you know, complete C personality change, you know, from very vibrant and outgoing to hiding in the, you know, the locker rooms and the library at lunchtime because I didn't have anybody to have lunch with in the cafeteria. Yeah.
Helene Cooper, now diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. We want to hear more about that transition and what took you back to Liberia, but we actually have a lot of listeners who want to join the conversation. Let me go to Sando calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Sando, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
Yeah, I really appreciate the conversation this morning and how objectively my sister there is. Actually, everything she said is very true. I was also part of the elite. My dad was...
In Liberia, Sando.
In Liberia, mm-hmm. Correct. At the time, today it is called Bombing County, but then it was called Bombing Territory. And my dad was the Tui Party chairman for the party, And I remember very clearly when he won the election for the party chairmanship, when we met with Dr. Talbot, who I appreciate very much.
The president.
Part of Baptist. Everything was set for us to take our office, and I was so glad. I was just happy that I was thinking on the car, the kind of car going to ride, and all the kind of stuff. But then, unfortunately for us, 2 days, it was two or three days, and we heard on the air that he had been overthrown. That was devastating for us. We were arrested, but my dad was very good to the locals in bombing territory. He was so kind, was very up for the people. And so when we were arrested, the locals came to our refuge, and they said, oh, no, these people are good people, you know, and that saved us.
But I notice you're now in the United States, not in Liberia. Did you ultimately flee your family as well?
Oh, yeah. We fled, and I got over here, and I did a lot of study about Rhode Island, and I liked the atmosphere in Rhode Island, and so I settled in Rhode Island. I healed my family.
When you look back, what do you think of the privilege that you and Helene Cooper's family had in Liberia?
Tom, to admit the fact, when I attended a Baptist mission called Swan Industrial Mission, on that mission, we also the Tauber niece and nephew attended the mission. And I was one of the guys who was on the mission, and I was against it. And I told the people, I kept telling them, I said, this thing, something going to happen. You cannot have a small group of people leading the vast majority of the people, and the people are suffering. And I was told to shut up. I shouldn't talk to open the eyes of the people. I said, so I was happy, even though I was young and maybe naive, but I was happy when the change came. It's just that I didn't know what the change was going to bring.
Right, and now you, like Helene, gone. We're going to look more at that Liberian situation. Sandra, thanks for that. Let me get one more call before the break here, if I may, from Joanne in Concord, Massachusetts. Joanne, you're on the air.
Hello. I just finished your book last night, Helene, and I loved it. And I thought to myself, I want to email her, but better still, I can just tell you it was one of the best books I've ever read. And I had read the article that you'd written in the New York Times that was sort of the prequel, and it whetted my appetite, and it was this was even better.
What did you find most moving, Joanne?
Oh, the whole story and the way her family coped so beautifully with horrible adversity. I mean, the tenacity, the courage, and the grace that they showed when, you know, people who had had such privilege could well have just fallen apart, and they didn't. They were wonderful.
Joanne, thank you with that direct report. Helene, how did your family emerge once it came to the States?
Well, thank you, Joanne. That really sort of warms my heart, because when I look back at sort of how we coped, I guess it's during the time it certainly didn't feel like we were coping gracefully. But it's nice to look back at it, and I guess it's true. When I finally did go back to Liberia, I guess the very fact that, you know, we're still standing, we're still, you know, functional, is good. When we first came to the United States after what had happened in Liberia, I think my mother has a lot of credit with how we handled it, because she never hid what had happened. She told us right away. And it wasn't something that was buried in the closet, although at the same time, it wasn't something that we talked about a lot. We never got therapy. Liberians don't go to therapy. Liberians don't get therapy. But it wasn't
something...
When you
say she told you, do you mean about your flight from Liberia, about her
No, she
rape
told me,
there?
She told us about the rape right as soon as it happened. We were locked up in the...
Yep.
In her
bedroom.
In her bedroom, and she came upstairs, and immediately, you know, she told us, and it was a horrible shock, but at the same time, it was not a big, horrible family secret. It wasn't anything that I was raised to be ashamed of, and I think that probably helped a lot. But at the same time, I also sort of, I don't know that I've handled how, you know, everything that happened after that as well as I could have, because I think I entered a period of denial where I just tried to put everything about Liberia,
Helene,
and what was happening in Liberia aside.
Hold the thought, if you would. We have a short break here. Michael Jackson with a song of his, one of her favorites at that time. And then it all ended. Helene Cooper's with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Don't stop till you get enough. Don't stop till you get enough. Don't stop till you get enough.
We're talking with New York Times diplomatic correspondent Helene Cooper about her new memoir of growing up elite in Africa and the destruction of everything she knew there, her family's flight and then its return. The book is The House at Sugar Beach. Helene joins us from St. Paul. We went out of that last segment with Michael Jackson, one of the songs that played on your record player in Liberia all the way back in, I don't know, 79, 1980. You clearly had a lot of American influences, a Lincoln and a Pontiac in the garage, and lots of cultural references, historical understanding of your family's connection to the United States. But when you arrived there as really a refugee, and it wasn't just a distant point of origin, but it was your new home, what did you make of American culture, Helene?
You know, I felt when we first got here, I was so cocky because I thought I knew America. You know, I did know Jackson 5, and we listened to disco music. I went to the American school in Liberia, and I grew up with my sisters practicing what we Liberians call talking kolo, which means putting on airs by speaking with an American accent. We got to Knoxville, Tennessee, and I realized just how African I really was. Nobody there. First of all, I was outraged that nobody there knew where Liberia was, because I knew where America was. I even knew where Knoxville was. How could they not know where I was from? I was also just very, I mean, beyond being traumatized, I was suddenly afraid. I didn't, you know, my world had sort of fallen apart and I didn't trust anything around me. It took me a year and a half to make friends. It wasn't until we moved to Greensboro that, you know, my junior year in high school.
In North Carolina.
I finally sort of started to come out of my shell. I would spend, when we first moved to Knoxville, I became addicted to ABC World News Tonight, because I was so upset that nobody knew where Liberia was that I would watch Brit Hume in front of the State Department doing his report, and I could imagine I saw the American flag, the Liberian flag behind him, and so I convinced myself
one of those zillions of flags in the hall
exactly.
There, Foggy Bottom.
I think that's part of why I ended up becoming a reporter. I think is because I wanted that connection with home.
Right.
The Liberian flag was at the State Department, and so I was sure that they knew where Liberia was at least, even if nobody around.
Somebody
me,
did.
Somebody
yeah.
did. Yeah. So it was sort of a slow metamorphosis, but it also, in kind of assuming, as I slowly assumed this new American identity, I started shedding my Liberian one, and that is probably it's probably a coping mechanism, but I don't think it's all as healthy as that is as it could be, because you know I couldn't get it in my head that I could be both. You know, I could fit in. All I wanted to do at the time as a teenager was to fit in here.
Of course, drop the one for the other, the old for the new.
Which is what I did, and that's not any way to live your life. And you know, it's in Liberia was slowly descending into, you know, civil war, and then Charles Taylor invaded
and
I ended up blocking it the way, you know, my father died in Liberia in 1985, and we had left one sister behind. But because so many people had died and the news reports of what was coming out of Liberia was so horrific, that I kind of decided that the only way I could deal with it was if I killed off everybody who had left in Liberia in my head, and that way they wouldn't hurt me when they died. And I so slowly ended up blocking Liberia out of my life, or trying to, which is pretty unhealthy.
Until, of all things, you found yourself as a reporter covering the American invasion of Iraq. In fact, you found yourself in a Humvee that an American tank had just run over. You were pinned to the wheel, feared that you might be about to die, and at a kind of a bolt from the blue.
It's sort of, nobody ever believes that these bolt from the blues, I guess is a near-death experience, that they actually happen. But I was lying on the ground in the desert after they pulled me out of the Humvee, and my chem suit was soaked they thought it was blood at the time, it turned out to be oil. And they're screaming, medevac, medevac, she's bleeding out. And all I could think of was, I shouldn't die here. This is a stupid war for me to die in. If I'm going to die in a war, I should die in a war in my own country. I should die in a war in Liberia. And it just suddenly became clear to me where I should be, where I should go.
And you turned back on the investigation that led to this memoir. We have so many callers for you. Let's go to North Providence, Rhode Island. Sayi, you're on the air with Helene Cooper.
Yes, Tom, thanks for taking my call. Great show.
Thank you.
Ellen, I want to thank you for being very poignant. Tom, everything she said thus far is on point, and it's to the point. Ellen, thanks so much for what you've said. But my question to you is, as we see now in Liberia, these things are coming back. I mean, after the war, and we have a new government, Ellen's doing well. But I see remnants of this very attitude. I was in Liberia last December. Mm. I went after 14 years. And what really bad for me is that, you know, you have people from the American descent, or the same Congo people, or even the country people themselves. I mean, these people are in that very abject part of the society. I saw a guy drive a Mercedes-Benz, two doors, white one, on a pothole road. And what I don't really get is, when are people going to get up and know that it takes a community, a village, to raise a child, and it would take that same cohesiveness, that same togetherness, to change the society? It baffles me that people in Liberia now, you know, are trying to live the same kind of lifestyle they had back in the 70s and the 80s, when the country itself is just to shreds. So my question is, what is it going to take to really change the minds of the people?
Eileen Cooper, and thank you very much, Saeed. The phone line's a little tough, but he's describing attitudes coming back. You know, somebody from the American descent, sort of Congo people, as you say, driving along in a Mercedes, even if it's falling apart on a potholed road, but trying to maintain that distinction. And where does cohesiveness come? Have you reengaged with Liberia now at 42 to the extent that you have, you know, opinions on Liberian politics and Liberian society today?
I have opinions. I don't know that I'm in the place at this point because I don't live in Liberia anymore, and I don't think I'm going to go back there and live. I think I want to go back and visit, and I want to reengage in Liberia on that level, but I don't think I'm quite at the point yet that I'm ready to move back. I think he raised a lot of good points, and I think a lot of Liberians are still in denial about, you know, what brought us to the point that we got to in 1980 and what ended up some of the forces that tore the country apart. I think until we actually accept it and we're honest with sort of our past and we examine it, we won't move on. There is a Truth and Reconciliation Commission on the style of the one in South Africa that's underway now that hopefully might actually, you know, help Liberians to engage in the kind of national dialogue that is clearly needed.
Let's take a call from Salt Lake City, Utah, and Jennifer. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question. I just pre-ordered your book. I haven't read it yet, and it just arrived. I have a question about what Americans can do to help Liberia now and, you know, looking into the future. I think I read your article in the New York Times, and I wept. I sent it to everybody I knew, and I hope that many Americans will be energized and invigorated by maybe some hope that's coming out of our Liberia. And can you speak to what we can do?
Jennifer, I'll ask Helene to do that, but may I ask you first, not all Americans are so engaged with Africa or you know, ready to really read. You wept at Helene's story. What's got you so focused on the African front?
I have to say, I read the New York Times online, and I just stumbled across it, and I had no idea that Americans returned to Liberia. I had no idea any of the history. Mm-hmm. And I just was sucked into the story. And it was the writing and the story. Also, that she talked so much about her family. And I just, you know, I was amazed how much she shared about what happened to her mother. It was a horrible experience. And I felt so much like, that could have been me. That could be my family. I mean, the way I read it, it was just like it had me.
A strong mother who saved her daughters from God knows what hell there, and kept on walking with them. Jennifer, thank you. Helene, what about Jennifer's question? She read it. She wept. She wants to know, you know, about the United States and Liberia, maybe Africa for that matter. And
I think it's such a good question. Like, you know, in part because one of the things that had always concerned me and that I didn't like was the fact that the United States basically founded Liberia and forgot about us. And I think a lot of Liberians feel that way today, even though, you will never find a more pro-American country in the world than Liberia. Mm. In 2003, after Charles Taylor finally left, President Bush sent 22 Marines to off the shore of Liberia, and Liberians went crazy. They were cheering on the beach, 22 soldiers. Mm-hmm. It's always been amazing how Liberia has always sort of felt like, the stepsister or the kid that you forget about when Liberians so love America and so want to not necessarily be part of America, but sort of be under, definitely wouldn't mind being under America's thumb. I think there's a lot that Americans do. I think the one thing I would say, to really simplify is just pay attention and engage with Liberia. There's a good new president right now, Africa's first female elected president of an African country, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who is, at this point, taking the first steps to digging this country out of a hole. But it needs so much in aid and in infrastructure and in all of that, just like education projects and that sort of thing. And to get Americans to engage in Liberia just on a grassroots roots level would go enormously far.
And how do you see, there's kind of the foreign policy front, your bailiwick, but also you're living here, you see this culture, you see the conversation it's involved in. How do you see race in this country, class, given the class, even caste background of your own native Liberia, and for that matter, Obama's candidacy, given his ties across that ocean as well?
It's so enormously complicated, yet it's also tied. I mean, once you start talking about race, and that is definitely one of the roots of the problems in both Liberia and in the United States. I mean, you get into all sorts of different mixes and strains, and you catch all sorts of things. They're so similar when you look at the issues of race in Liberia, the issues of skin color and the tint of your skin in Liberia, and you look at that here in the United States. It's almost as if you're looking at mirror images.
Let's go to Sarah in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Sarah, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom, and hello, Helen. Your story is very, very touching. However, I see it as something very, very classic of most African developing nations or developed nations, that it seems to be something that is post-imperialism or post-colonial, where the true essence of democracy is not realized, and we tend to be more autocratic and keep the money to a few population group of the nation.
Right.
I think we need to start learning how to apply and work towards middle class, distributing the wealth equally, try to learn from the West the way that they've done it, to be able to organize themselves in a manner that abject poverty, deprivation, certain people getting more privilege doesn't become a lasting thing to suppress the progress of the many. So if there's something to learn from this, we have to start reaching out how the rich few in those nations, whether you're talking about African nations or third world nations, have to reach out and build middle class, give more people opportunity, distribute the wealth as much as they can, and uplift the nation, not individual gains.
Sarah, thank you very much for your call, and I'm sorry we can't get to more. Helene, you wouldn't believe how many we just had to let go. Sim in Fort Myers, Florida, who grew up swimming on Sugar Beach, the beach your house was on, says he wishes he was back there. But what about Sarah's point? She said this is a pattern, in Liberia. Yeah. It's repeated. How do you break the mindset that supports it? Privilege.
Her point is excellent, because also, and what she was talking, I wanted to add, African countries have blamed their woes for the last 50 years on post-colonialism. I've heard that, my entire growing up, I've heard that excuse is because, these are new countries and they're newly independent from the Europeans, and so they're just feeling the way. I think until we as Africans start to accept responsibility for our behavior and stop looking to the West to bail us out, but to also blaming them for the way we treat each other, I don't think we're going to get very far. I think the first step is acceptance of our own culpability.
You mentioned earlier that as a teenager, it was, you know, you couldn't be both American and Liberian. You wanted to adapt to the country that your family had been sort of almost pushed to at gunpoint. What about now? How do you understand your own cultural roots, your nationality? Are you now, at last, at 42, both?
Yeah, I think I am. I get asked a lot by people, are you, you know, do you feel more American or Liberian? And my answer always is, when I'm in the United States, I feel very Liberian. And when I leave the United States, I feel American. Except for when I go to Liberia, which is, and then I feel absolutely, completely Liberian. I think it's possible to live in two worlds. It can be difficult. It's, you know, sometimes you feel like you're straddling. But I can never forget, you know, when I go home, that bone deep, you know, sense of pride I still get, no matter how awful it looks and how war torn and, you know, just how much of a basket case sometimes the country seems as if it's in. I still get this bone deep sense of pride that this is somewhere that, you know, I finally have proof I do come from somewhere.
And this, the house in Sugar Beach, you were back there. How does it look today?
It looks like the one of those ruins you see in, you know, the Roman ruins or something. It's a shell of itself. There are squatters living there now. You know, our rogues have taken, you know, the glass and all of that. But it's still standing there, and it's sort of still, you know, in a lot of ways, I feel still standing there as a monument to my childhood.
Childhood, very much gone. Maybe a kind of moral, but I'm not sure how to define it right there. Your telling of it is really wonderful, though, Helene, and we thank you for sharing some of it with us today. The new memoir is The House at Sugar Beach, In Search of a Lost African Childhood. Helene Cooper, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Go out with Sweet Liberia by Zach and Giba. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.